So we've been discussing the last, in this Hashkafa Shirim, because we started with Hilchos Tshuva, so we've been discussing the relationship between, the norm, the objective the requirement of Maisa Mitzvah, and the relationship that it has with, producing, a basis for character development, midos, or the relationship it has with emunos and deos, the proper beliefs, theological, philosophical, as well as the impact it has in cultivating, let's say, a value system. The assumption of all of this is really that there really are two elements or two dimensions, broadly speaking, in Torah life. One is the norm itself, the halacha, the obligation to actually implement and observe measurable, objective performances. That's called Avodas Hashem. And that that carries with it an interesting relationship, right, to the kind of effect that it's supposed to have on the human personality. And these really are the two elements. And clearly, again, the interaction between the two is a complicated matter, but also an indispensable one. We couldn't conceive of a, halachic system, which focused on objective performances that was shorn from or divorced from thought and ideals and principles and values and midos tovos. That would constitute more of a mechanical a testing ground, perhaps, in terms of compliance with the divine will, but it'd be hard to justify the degree of halachocentrism, if that's really what it was all about. We already noted in previous discussions that when Chazal speak about Lo Nitna Torah Ela Letzareh Pesabrios, or Midosav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, again, that Omer Al Kansipor Yangi Rachamecha Mishaskino, so She'osa Midosav Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu Racham in the Inan and Alexeros, that there are two ways that Chazal understand that, and that one way really does focus on discipline, testing, it's, kind of the metal, L-E, of man's devotion and commitment to the Ribbono Shel Olam, is reflected, right, in his ability to follow in disciplined manner, not to ask questions, but, simply to observe and to implement. In that sense, letzarei fesabrios, meaning, just also spoke in context of shechita, doesn't matter whether you do shechita min atzava or min ha'orah, one of the things that Chazal speak about. So there is an element for sure, Vashem Nisa as Abraham, and of course in the context of Chukim, that's certainly a part of it. Chok Chak Dilcha Inucha Rishus Lahar Her Acharai. There is an element of discipline for sure, and testing, when it comes to that. There are those who see this element as being very central. Again, the Kuzari, in particular, thought that the idea of Shmiras HaMitzvos as an expression of simply being a mitzvah and following the will of the Ribbono Shel Olam, everybody agrees that that's a crucial element. But even to the degree of being reticent a little bit, hesitant about, or at least ambivalent about pursuing Tamei HaMitzvos, pursuing a better understanding of what this is all about, might be more of a lechatchila. Again, not exactly a Kierkegaardian approach, but something close to it, let's say, in Yahadus. Certainly that is a dimension, there's no question about that. But again, the more normative view is that while the Tzivui Hashem does test man, and that commitment is defined by punctilious observance, notwithstanding comprehension, namely nasa v'nishma, We talked about this a lot last year, as I recall, in Nasa V'Nishma. But the ideal still is, even in Chukim, and certainly generally, that you know, that Nasa is followed by Nishma, just that the Nasa is also the basis of the Nishma, as we'll discuss, meaning it's a reconstruction of the Nasa. It comes from, it flows from, it stems from, or derives from, radiates from the Nasa, from the norm, and that becomes the basis for the Nishma, but that there really is a Nishma, and obviously that's a much more appealing view. Again, you could say that there are different aspects of Yadus, you know, Chukim and Mishpatim. You could say that even in Mishpatim, the motivation for following always has to be Tzivui Hashem. In that sense, every Mishpat, you know, has a Chuk element. But it's also very appealing in the more, again, accepted view, is that even the, you know, even the Chukim have a Mishpatim element. Namely, even if it's difficult for us to penetrate, then there is an inner logic, and there is at least a benefit. And the Torah is, the halacha is encouraging of the effort to try to penetrate, if not, you know, fully divine will, at least to understand better, you know, and to integrate that understanding, you know, not only into our actions, but into our mindset, again, the cultivation of values, etc. And again, the Rambam clearly, notwithstanding his very rationalistic orientation, something which is undeniable in everything that he wrote, not just in Morna Buchan, but in Yana Chazaka, and everything that he wrote, nonetheless, is very has an interesting perspective on Chukim as he develops it in the end of Hilchos Me'ila and other places, and that is that Chukim take priority over Mishpatim in terms of being significant in the hierarchy, but at the same time, and that, of course, is a chiddush for somebody like the Rambam's orientation, who has the Rambam's orientation. But at the same time, and this is the consistent part, Chukim themselves have an inner logic, and it would be, you know, it's preferable for man to try to penetrate what that inner logic really is. So this is the kind of the background for what we're talking about. You know, Bereishis bara Elokim, Bishvila Torah Shenikra Reishis, you know, Stako Baraisa Ubara Alma, all those other statements in Chazal, you know, the idea of Shemosav Shalakadosh Baruch Hu. We live to implement, to develop a kesher with the Ribbono Shalom and to implement his will. His will is expressed in the mitzvos, but that the mitzvos are sine qua non, whether we understand them or not, as a mitzvah, but at the same time, a knowledgeable Jew, not just a nishma, a Nasa Jew, but a Nasa V'Nishma Jew, who has the right priorities and also is going about epistemologically trying to develop a Hashkafas HaOlam in the right way, that's what we're going to talk about a little more, that is the preference. The halacha centricity, in other words, of the Torah is not meant to formalize and, you know, mechanize, you know, in a robotic kind of fashion, mitzvot anashim melumada. There's always that danger when you focus on measured, concrete, you know, physical actions, but it's meant to be the methodology of concretizing on the one hand and of penetrating more deeply as a result, right, into man's psyche, into his way of thinking and providing him, you know, with a foundation. The Torah might have started at a Chodesh Hazeh Lachem, not because it doesn't care about Hashkafa, but because in addition to, you know, being, you know, the beginning of the halacha, right, the halacha itself embodies Hashkafa. So that's kind of the foundation of all of this, and that's really what's singular about Yadus. It's the, I spoke on Shabbos for those who were here, about the idea of being motzi, Ramban's idea, but expanding it, minakoach ala poel, meaning knowing what's in your heart and in your mind. You know, A doesn't help other people, if we're looking for paradigms, but even in terms of self-awareness, self-knowledge, and reinforcement in the person himself, we believe that, you know, actions have impact. Again, the chinuch you know, his system is based on it, but the Rambam says it very explicitly many places as well. And consequently, this idea of trying to develop, let's say, a hashkafas ha'olam, a Weltanschauung, an ethos, whatever it is, a perspective on life, is really incumbent upon all shomrei mitzvos. Again, it's not a substitute for kalila. It can only come from first acknowledging, you know, that the tzivui stands in its own right and is not contingent upon an awareness and understanding. But once you have that, then actually, you know, the conduciveness of, you know, actually accomplishing in the reconstruction of the halachic norm a system of halacha is something that becomes much greater, that becomes more more doable in many ways. So this effort, you know, obviously triggered a lot of discussion in the world of Chazal, and in the world of the Rishonim, and then in the world, you know, of later thinkers, including modern thinkers. How exactly, again, how appropriate and what is the relationship between Shmiras HaMitzvos and the Hashkafas HaOlam, number one, but also how one should go about, like, what's the best method of trying to extract, or in a world perspective, you know, from the measured objective norms. And to some extent, I think Eitan asked me this question over Shabbos, right? All right. To some extent, this is the question of Darshino Taima Dekra. Well, this is part of my response, but implicit in this question, which is a debate already in the Gemara. Again, I want to speak more generally today. Maybe we'll build on some of the pieces another time. If you look at the case of Darshin and Talmud Dekra, it's clear that partially, at least, this is the what's the relationship between, you know, the mitzvah, the chiyuv, the din, you know, and its purpose, its objective. The truth is that there, you know, we have a narrower connection in a way. Then we're talking about, you know, more obvious cause and effect, or a more obvious objective, one is that is stated, you know, explicitly in the Torah. And the issue revolves more around the impact that that has halachically. In other words, if you hold Darshin and Talmud Dekra and the Torah, not our efforts based on what we're going to discuss in a minute, cumulative evidence, reconstruction, you know, lumdus, you know, the understanding the nuances and the details more subtly. That's really what we're going to get to in this discussion. But, you know, where the Torah itself actually provides, you know, an explanation, or the explanation is pretty overt, right? Mm-hmm. What is the relationship from a halachic point of view, from an observing point of view, from a how mandatory, you know, is it, you know, to actually carry out, you know, the objective, you know, mitzvah, you know, when we have already identified its goal, and, you know, based on understanding that goal or applying that goal, you know, sometimes it becomes superfluous, or sometimes it's substitutable for maybe a more efficient, you know, or a more ambitious, you know, way of accomplishing the same thing. So, you know, flayar belo susim or nashim, you know, is, you know, to preclude, you know, either returning to Mitzrayim or other potential, you know, pitfalls, you know, for the king, right? So if the circumstances are compelling, you know, maybe you can drop that particular halach. So Darshin and Talmud Dekra, I would say, on two levels, is a little bit different than what we're talking about. Number one, as I say, it's mostly either explicit or obvious, overt, what this idea is about. Number two, the issue there is about the relationship between these explicit or overt motivations and the applications, which is a legal question, you know, kind of a low plug question or something of that sort. And number three, typically, we're talking about in these overt motivations, you know, typically we're talking about something that is a little bit more extraneous, meaning, you know, cause and effect. The common denominator is more, you know, efficiency, you know, than anything else. But there's not inherently anything wrong with the melech, you know, having, you know, too many susim, you know, or too many wives, you know, but, you know, we're worried, well, yes, the, you know, the hasaras levavo, I guess, is a little more connected. The yashuv, you know, Mitzrayim, you know, is obviously, you know, connected, but, you know, in a more direct way in terms of cause and effect, an indirect way in terms of the content. Again, the nashim and the yasur levavo, that's an interesting question. You can either look at that as having an extraneous relationship, albeit a very pragmatically compelling one, or being something more subtle and more substantive. But at the end of the day, typically discussions of Darshin and Talmud Dikra, as they say, are about, include those three components. Again, to demonstrate this more fully and to speak about some of the more nuanced cases, we'd have to really, you know, go into it. We can do that. I don't know, you know, what the plan is, but we'll talk. And therefore, that's not really what we're talking about, a hashkafa of halacha, more general terms, you know, not so much connected to the question of Darshin and Talmud Dikra. The phrase Darshin and Talmud Dikra, you know, was also used in a wider way that sometimes overlaps with Tamei Mitzvos, or Tamei Mitzvos is sometimes used in a narrower way, which sometimes overlaps with Darshin and Talmud Dikra, or with, you know, Hashkafa. But it's important to know from the cases, even the question of, even everything that is under the rubric of Darshin and Talmud Dikra in the Gemara, and the Rishonim, you know, provides a bit of a range, and the possibility of, you know, paskening, you know, Darshin and Talmud Dikra about certain things, and low Darshin and Talmud Dikra about other things, obviously is opened up, you know, by the notion that we're dealing with, you know, not every one of Darshin and Talmud Dikra has the three characteristics, let's say, you know, that I identified, and, you know, maybe some of them are closer to the enterprise of Tamei Mitzvos. The enterprise of Tamei Mitzvos mostly was not intended at all by those who pursued it, you know, to have legal, meaning halachic, observance ramifications at all. And, you know, the at the same time, in the larger history of Tamei Mitzvos, and, you know, what that enterprise, you know, as it was practiced by a wide range of people, one of the characteristics, as no one said about Tamei Mitzvos, that, you know, batal ha-tam, you know, batal ha-mitzvah, or it's substitutable, you know, it's a sine qua non, you know, to pursuing Tamei Mitzvos, that you reject that notion. Again, Sefer HaChinuch, you know, instructs his son, you know, again and again, you know, about that. So do others. But, again, typically many Tamei Mitzvos, or there's a range in Tamei Mitzvos, some Tamei Mitzvos also were characterized by a more extraneous link or cause and effect, you know, kind of link between the Tam and the Mitzvah. In other words, while there wasn't any question of the low plug or of observance or the, maybe the idea, as the Chinuch and others develop it, that, you know, even if there are Tamei Mitzvos, there are often multiple Tamei Mitzvos. So that even if a particular tam, you know, is batel, the mitzvah is not batel, A, you know, because, you know, it has a status of its own, and B, because your tam doesn't encompass the totality of that particular mitzvah, therefore it can never be batel. So it isn't just a matter of lo plug, you know, or the source of authority, or the idea that it, you know, ends up having sanctity in its own right, but that simply you haven't exhausted, and therefore you can never substitute for or, you know, link observance with the rationale behind the particular mitzvah. But the truth is that if you look at some of the Tamei mitzvos, we are struck by how some systems, at least, are very pragmatic. And again, if not for these, if not for these preconditions, let's say, to the enterprise itself, the temptation, for substitution, or for the Tama mitzvah affecting, the application of the mitzvah itself would be great. And included in that, group, one could say, are, ironically, the Rambam in Mor Nebuchim, who, is very historical or historicist in his Tamei mitzvos in that work. A lot of things have to do with, what Jews and non-Jews did or didn't do, or other kind of relativist or historical elements. The Rambam was roundly criticized, for the quality and for the implications of some of his Tamei mitzvos. In the end of Halachic Mind, about three books here, I don't know if I'm going to get to them all today, one of them is the Halachic Mind, which I'll hopefully speak of a little bit, that the very end of it, an essay that the Rav wrote on epistemology, that, the last 30 or so pages are the, the halachic part. Till then, it's like an analysis of epistemology, which is very fascinating. Probably a little outdated, but doesn't really matter. It really reflects a lot of insight and wisdom and, impressive grasp or control of the literature of the time in many, many different fields. But that's one of the books I brought. I brought Chorev, which is Rafal Hirsch's Tamei mitzvos work. And there's an excellent introduction, Diane Grunfeld, who put it out. So he just draws from Rav Hirsch's writings, about his perspective on Tamei mitzvos, or really developing a halachic, system of thought through the halacha. And then again, Rav Hirsch's Gesammelte Schriften, otherwise known as collected writings. When he wrote it, it was Gesammelte Schriften, where he has, again, it's all over his works, but particularly the essay, The Outlook on Life, but even more, the essay, did I bring the wrong one? Developing, at least it's closer there, Developing a Jewish Weltanschauung. Is that right? Yeah, okay. I don't know why they don't have it in the table of contents. Jewish Weltanschauung, which is another way of saying, Jewish or halachic hashkafa. But it sounds better when you say Jewish Weltanschauung. Okay. Especially with the umlauts and everything else that goes with it. Anyways, the Rav in the end of Halachic Mind, has the famous comment where he talks about the Rambam's Tamei mitzvos, and he basically says that, while, those who know him, will hardly accuse him of being a Rambam critic, everybody knows, that he and his family legacy are ardent, Rambam, passionate Rambam, supporters, that nonetheless, I should have bookmarked the part, that nonetheless, when it comes to Tamei mitzvos, that he finds himself, left kind of cold by the Rambam's Tamei mitzvos in Mor Nebuchim. Then he goes on to say that he much prefers the Ramban's Tamei mitzvos to the Rambam's Tamei mitzvos, and that, however, if you read the Yad HaZaka, but the Tamei mitzvos on the Yad HaZaka are of a completely, here it is, a different type. Here. Although the method of regular, okay, fine. Maimonides' failure to impress his rationalistic method upon the vivid religious consciousness is to be attributed mainly to the fact that the central theme of this exposition is the causalistic problem, the how question, or the why question, the explanatory quest, and the genetic attitude determine Maimonides' doctrine of the commandments. Instead of describing, Maimonides explained. Instead of reconstructing, deconstruct, this is what Eitan was referring to a little bit over Shabbos. As we have previously indicated, whenever the causal question is raised, if I'll explain all this in a minute, the philosopher must transcend the boundary lines of religion in order to find his answer, which lies beyond the religious domain. For example, should we pose the question, why did God forbid perjury? The intellectualistic philosopher would promptly reply, because it is contrary to the norm of the truth. Thus, he would explain a religious norm by an ethical precept, making religion the handmaid of ethics. And then he adds, it is worthy of note that Maimonides, the halakhic scholar, came nearer to the core of philosophical truth than Maimonides, the speculative philosopher. In contradistinction to the causal method of the philosophical guide that leads to a religious techne, right, the halakhic code, Mishneh Torah, apprehends the religious act in an entirely different light. The code does not pursue the objective causation of the commandment, but attempts to reconstruct its subjective correlative, right? It would seem that Maimonides of the halakha was not intrigued by the how question. He freed himself from the genetic purview and employed a descriptive method expounding the content and symbolic meaning of the religious norm. The what question was his guide in the code. To illustrate this methodological difference between the guide and the code, we may cite three examples. The first one is shofar, and so on. The examples are interesting. Earlier, as I say, he has this, you know, cute line where he talks about, you know, having good Rambam credentials, but, you know, feeling that, you know, he should share his authentic, you know, feelings about the superiority of the Ramban over the Rambam and of Yad HaChazaka over Mor Nebuchim in this particular sense. The Rambam's Tamei Mitzvos and Mor Nebuchim, you know, have been criticized by many. Mostly, the numerous of the specific ta'amim have been criticized. Certainly, his famous view on karbanos, you know, as being kind of a either or a combination, you know, of again a historical historicist explanation. You know, this is you know, to and as well as kind of an appeal to the lower, you know, expectations of Klal Yisrael, you know, in the formative, you know, days of accepting, you know, halacha as the system, that these are people, in other words, that need to be weaned off of, you know, avodah zarah and the more crude and, you know, concrete, you know, acts of worship. Oh, and therefore, you know, the only way to do that, you know, was to kind of harness, you know, animal sacrifice, you know, and to turn it into avodas Hashem. So obviously that was something that triggered a lot of criticism. The Ramban, of course, was very critical in his parish in Vayikra. The Ritva, in his defense of the Rambam, basically has one line in which he kind of says, well, you know, the Rambam was trying to explain not the content of Kabanos, which he felt was lofty, probably as lofty as the Ramban did, but the choice, the divine choice, right, to formulate, you know, these lofty principles and ideals, you know, in this particular form or mode. In other words, whatever is supposed to be accomplished or conveyed or transmitted, the lofty principles in Avodas HaKarbanos, right, they are. So as Chefta Shel Torah, my words now, not the Ritva's, but as Chefta Shel Torah, you know, they are intrinsic, and they are, you know, ideal. You know, but in theory, you know, the Ribbono Shel Olam has, you know, infinite ways of transmitting values, you know, and principles. So the choice, again, this is like one line or two lines in the Ritva, but it struck my attention anyway. I think is what he's saying. But the choice to, you know, to use this particular mechanism, you know, also was intended to accomplish, you know, a goal at a point in history, meaning in the initial, you know, periods, you know, the tentative, you know, steps that Klal Yisrael was taking, you know, to wean themselves away. Maybe they took a mode and a method, you know, which had this other benefit as well. But either way, the point is that a lot of the Rambam's suggestions in Mordechai Vukum, not all, some of them are actually quite idealistic and substantive, but a lot of them certainly, you know, relate to, you know, what the, you know, practice was at the time of Maimon Har Sinai, you know, and they do have this historicist element, which is for sure disappointing. In the Yad HaChazakah, you know, the orientation, as the Rav notes, is completely different. There, it's all about, you know, capturing, right, certain principles, you know, by action, something which is much closer to what, you know, we idealistically look at as a hashkafa of halacha. The Rambam's Tamei Mitzvos and Mor Nebuchadnezzar that were criticized, again, many of them on an individual level, but when you take a step back at a bigger level, kind of highlight a certain challenge, you know, that Tamei Mitzvos and different efforts had. And that was, again, to, you know, relative to, you know, what I mentioned about Darshin and Talmud Dikra, you know, the explanations were very general, and many of them appeared to be extraneous, either in terms of what they wanted to accomplish, or the relationship between, let's say, the content, you know, and the symbol, or the method. And that, you know, is something which many critics didn't articulate, but clearly was at root of what disturbed them and what motivated their kind of distaste for or suspicion, you know, that Tamei Mitzvos as an enterprise, you know, might be more counterproductive, you know, than productive. Somebody once made the Ha'ara, and I mentioned this in response to Eitan's question the other night, you know, that if you look, for example, at I guess the more rationalistic Tamei Mitzvos, and you compare them to Kabbalistic Tamei Mitzvos, it could be that Tishbi makes this point, could be, in his Hakdama to Mishnah HaZohar, not sure, but I think it's an insightful comment. Kabbalistic Tamei Mitzvos are much more internal, organic, and much more connected to the details of the halacha itself. Whereas the more rationalistic Tamei Mitzvos were more, as I say, general, extraneous, like you'll see many Sefer Chinuch, which is, you know, more, in terms of orientation, much closer to the Ramban than the Rambam, even though, again, the order of the mitzvos are mostly dictated by the Rambam, which is an interesting phenomenon. But, you know, you'll see that, you know, many of the mitzvos, you know, yeah, this one too, like all the mikdash ones are practically the same. And again, taharos are practically the same. I'm not being critical of that, but I think it's an interesting phenomenon. And there's a certain, the point was being made that there's a certain appeal to the Kabbalistic ones. You know, lu yitzuyar, you can, you know, find meaning in them. That's a big if, you know, for people who are mostly exoterically oriented. I don't mean that there aren't Chalila meaning. I mean, you know, the world of Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, is a world that that is part of Yahadus. But it is a more esoteric world. So, you know, you have to be somebody who is, you know, trained in it and, you know, has a certain attunement to it, you know, to really appreciate it and understand it. You know, so that's a huge obstacle. On the other hand, the idea that it addresses, you know, internally, you know, matters of you know, of halacha, and that in a more detailed way is hugely appealing, right, if you're not interested in just generalizing. Moreover, and certainly in the case of the Rambam and Mor Nebuchadnezzar and some others as well, right, the tendency was to be, as I say, externally kind of motivated. And some of the critique was that, you know, what was really happening was that, you know, people engaged in this enterprise were imposing external philosophic, you know, convictions, which obviously they felt were compatible, you know, with Yahadus, but, you know, rather than this being like an organic presentation of something that is more, you know, singular, you know, to Yahadus itself. In other words, if you can mostly interchange, let's say, your Tameh Mitzvos system of Hashkafa, you know, with some secular philosophical system or other, you know, religion that has broad, you know, common, you know, beliefs in some respects, but in a broad way, but not in a specific way, as if you're ignoring what makes Yadus and what makes halakhic law, you know, very specific and unique, then you really aren't accomplishing much in Tameh Mitzvos. Again, it's a little bit different than the Roshin and Tam of the Krah argument, but it's not, you know, it overlaps it, as you can see. So this really was, everybody who criticized previous Tameh Mitzvos pretty much took this route, and then they proposed, you know, their own, which was intended to be, you know, free of this criticism, in a more purist, a more insider, you know, approach, a more organic, a more, you know, halachically, characteristically singular, let's say, approach to Tameh Mitzvos. And, you know, and they in turn were kind of judged by the extent to which they were, you know, successful, you know, in avoiding the problem of imposing, you know, and being more either extraneous or too general, or not. And that, of course, is a certain irony in that people who kind of, you know, projected systems, you know, based on that critique, and then, you know, 50 years later or 100 years later, you know, people responded, you know, almost identically, you know, to that. So what's clear is that the ideal of Tameh Mitzvos, we have to call it Tameh Mitzvos kind of a little bit became tarnished as an enterprise, even though, again, it's something that is embraced by the Rishonim and possibly even by Chazal, because of this association, let's say, with a more apologetic, a more external, as I say, too general, too universal orientation. And the, you know, the goal, I guess, you know, always was to try to produce, you know, something that is, that aligns more, you know, singular, in a more singular fashion, more specifically, with the details of halacha, and, you know, which may use terminology as the communication of it and the formulation of it, conveying it, transmitting it, you know, it might be helpful to use or to borrow from other systems. You know, you don't have to always reinvent the wheel. Moreover, there's an audience, you know, depending on when, you know, everybody who, you know, who takes up this challenge is doing so in a historical and cultural context. There also may be an agenda. There certainly was for the Rambam and Mordechuchim, much more so than, you know, Yad HaChazaka's agenda was with Dori Doros. Mordechuchim was more likely a narrower agenda, which explains a lot of the discrepancies. Doesn't mean he didn't mean what he said, but, you know, it doesn't mean either that he was, you know, formulating things, you know, to, you know, to a to the same crowds or to the eternity, you know, crowd either. But again, another issue. So you'd have to know also, you know, what the agendas are. Again, a Morel and Nevuchim is going to be different than, you know, a Mishneh Torah. And somebody, you know, basically addressing the crisis of faith or people's questions, you know, in the, you know, in the 16th century is going to speak, you know, in different vocabulary, and maybe depending on what the crisis or the circumstances are, just from a responsibility point of view as well, this and whatever the agenda is, you know, going to address things somewhat differently than somebody in the 19th century or in the 21st century or the 20th century, for that matter. So it's important in thinking about these questions, to be aware of all of this, not to be, dismissive of the use of, external terminology per se, because sometimes that can be very useful, but to be at least aware, conscious that, there has to be a certain, litmus test, to try to figure out, kind of an initial skepticism whether the agenda and or the terminology, the cultural context, et cetera, is kind of diluting the substance of the goal of the enterprise, being not merely to to explain to people who have questions, that also being very critical, but especially to present or represent in the most ideal way, what the singular hashgafas ha'olam of Yahadus is really all about. So if you take the two books that I brought in, is of Woman the Rav, the other is Rav Shamshon Paul Hirsch, both of them, I think, were, as I said, in other contexts, unique expositors of the halachic system. Both of them had, the kind of philosophic background and, wider appreciation, of the challenges, but also wider appreciation of Yahadus, which equipped them to kind of tackle this question. And both of them held strong the conviction that halachocentrism, we'll say, had been neglected in the pursuit of, call it Talmid Mitzvos, or the effort to extract or to formulate halachic, hashkafas ha'olam. So this, if you look at the, again, this essay, what did I say it was? Jewish Weltanschauung. Maybe I'll read a little bit from next time. So, Rav Hirsch, and again, in everything that he writes, these are two very, the Rav and Rav Hirsch are very consistent thinkers. The patterns of their thought, which is a good thing. Meaning they're very sophisticated thinkers and writers, and very creative, but they're also very consistent. Meaning whatever they wrote, after having, kind of digested and reflected and, evaluated everything, and, that's just their style. As I say, they share a lot in common. There's a century between them, but in terms of sophistication and in terms of the goal. So Rav Hirsch writes a lot about the, mostly he's also responding to the reform movement in his time, Geiger and others, who he says basically have adopted, Kantian world orientation. And as it happens, Rav Hirsch admires Kant a lot and thinks that there is much in Kant that is admirable and helpful. But, certain aspects of his thought obviously are antithetical to, all religions, frankly, and especially to Yahadut. So his critique is, you can't, the second that you impose, the totality of Kant, on Judaism, you're no longer, even involved in the enterprise of trying to define Yahadus in the world of Torah, but you're shaping it, you basically have, given away the store or lost the game, before you've begun, because it's a totally different orientation, it's extraneous, and it can't possibly, Yahadus cannot meet the criteria of Kantian philosophy, because they're inherently antithetical. So you basically, surrendered, before you have begun. But his larger critique is that any Talmid Mitzvos needs to be centered upon the halacha itself. After all, that's what's binding, that's where Skar and Onesh come from, and that is what is singular to Yahadus. And his big argument is, you know, that what the Reform called ceremonies or ceremonial, you know, laws, right, have a certain, that has a certain connotation. Other religions, he argues, their ceremonies or ceremonial laws are created by man. And they're just, you know, an effort to kind of concretize, you know, the ideals or the principles, you know, of that religion. But in Yadus, our belief is that Torah is Misinai, and therefore the mitzvahs themselves, you know, have a divine imprimatur. They're not ceremonies. They are Ratzon Hashem. And therefore embedded in the norm itself, you know, perfectly is the idea, but even more so, the observance deepens and makes possible an appreciation of the ideal. So this is a major theme in his writings and in his critique of previous Tamei HaMitzvos, that it's too extraneous, too borrowed from other systems and other worlds, even though, again, his own use of terminology and philosophy, including Kant, ironically, but I think absolutely appropriately, he was criticized for this, by the way. That's what I'm trying to say, ironic. People said, well, you know, Rav Hirsch, you know, is very critical, you know, of Tamei HaMitzvos that come from somewhere else, that aren't organic, they're not flowing out of Chazal and the Gemara, you know, and the Halacha and the Rambam, right? But isn't he himself, you know, very enamored with, and look at his terminology and his categories? So I think that the answer to that question is, you know, probably here and there the criticism is correct, like it is for anyone. But, you know, Rav Hirsch, like Rav, was such a great expositor of the system, and his filters, I think, were so effective, and they were so, integral to his integrity, you know, and what he was all about, that you have to distinguish between, you know, how you phrase things, you know, for various reasons, and both in terms of the, you know, receptivity, as well as, you know, your own acute powers of expression, which sometimes are aided by that kind of knowledge, and whether or not, you know, the terminology and the references and so on end up undermining, like, the organic or the independent nature of it. And the same basic approach was taken by the Rav, he doesn't quote Rav Hirsch, but, you know, like 100 years later, both in the halachic mind and in everything that he did. While Rav Hirsch focuses broadly on halacha and also very much on language, as well as parshanut, the Rav's is, you know, less so on language. Part of Rav Hirsch's approach was a belief in you know, certain heavy linguistic, you know, Hebrew language carrying certain a very heavy weight, if you will, you know, certain principles, which I think is a little more maybe the weak part of his general system. I think now and then it's very impressive, and oftentimes people perceive it, and I think correctly, as being a little more contrived. But the Rav, of course, had the benefit of you know, being from Beis Sabrisk, you know, not only, you know, being a halachist, we're going to stop in 1 second, but, you know, Rav Hirsch was too, and he, again, the effort was to align, you know, the substance of this presentation with the details of halacha. That's his program, and I think he's true to it. But I think what's unique about the Rav's contribution, the same, again, impulse and the same criticism, the same agenda, but because of the halachic school that the Rav, you know, was born into and, you know, continued to help develop, and was such a master of, is the school of Brisk, which itself focuses on the notion of inner logic and the independence, let's say, of halachic values and principles, separate from, you know, any extraneous system. That's like almost built in more to the lumdus, to the halachic and analytical derech of Brisk. I think that also equipped the Rav even more so, right, to identify the need for this kind of more internal and intrinsic and halachic minutia approach to extracting a value system from the halakha. So that's just a bit of an introduction. We'll stop here. What I want to do next time is this. I want to read a little bit, just to show you that I'm not making it up. But then I want to talk about how you actually do it, or how I think you actually do it, and, you know, try to connect it to what we do. And we'll see. You know. Okay, is that what we wanted? You'll tell me if it gets...